Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the podcast. It is Sunday. Sunday, not Friday. True crime time? It's Easter. Wait, what? As is often the case on many holidays, Jen and I like to do a bonus episode. So Jen has graciously devoted some of her Easter day to this, and I appreciate that. How are you, Jen?
I'm doing good. The fur kids are digging into their Easter baskets. So
are they?
Well, they're occupied. I figured we would get into a different type of Easter mystery. You know, one that contains maybe hunting Easter eggs, but not the type that your children are going to hunt. You know, these are the type of Easter eggs that are more like scams, you know, that you want to avoid, things that invade your privacy for profit.
Yes, not the Easter eggs you will often see teased in movies or on DVDs. These are or Easter eggs that you hunt, but these are Easter eggs nonetheless. They're, you know, it's a Easter egg where people are trying to fish for information and fish with a PH. Not the group.
Definitely not the group. Just going to be, you know, some reasons why you should never call or text a phone number that you do not know.
You know, let me tell you a little bit about, I have always been probably one of the last human beings in the U.S. who had a BlackBerry. And the just because I enjoyed the tactile function where I could actually type. And one of the downfalls of the BlackBerry, other than the fact that they never updated anything, and so the operating system was essentially just a phone and Microsoft Word, is that I was unable to block calls or texts. They just did not have that software. So I, you know, would get tons every single day. So then recently I switched to a phone company that allows me, not a phone company, a phone that allows me to actually block. And I will tell you that my life is a great deal more relaxed. These phone numbers no longer appear, which is lovely. The texts don't appear. It's just amazing to me. With technology today, that, I mean, just, it's just constant. And there's not usually a person at the other end. It's just, you know, the software, and it is remarkable what people will do and to try and get information. So tell us, you know, a little bit about this hidden Easter egg thing that we are going to talk about today.
Yeah, because it's coming up more often in the news to beware of scams that are linked to, you know, financially linked scams, phishing, as they call it. And, you know, in reality, there's other scams that can be far more dangerous and super creepy. I mean, how far things can go all depends on who answers the phone. I mean, we're talking about callers who can physically reach you without having left their own dwelling. And you ask, you know, how can they do that? Well, it all goes back to this thing called the Milgram experience and the Hoffling Hospital experiment. Ooh. And this little word called compliance. And it's all super chilling in nature. And you can research any of those topics.
One of the things, I guess, is that people can be persuaded to participate in situations that they know aren't correct. And it depends on kind of who's advising them. And the more authority that the advisor has, the less likely someone is to question them, even when they have good reason to. And one of the ones that you found that really fascinates me is this strip search phone scammer. I mean, because this lasted a long, long time.
Yeah, it started out in the early 90s and it lasted nearly 12 years. And as we get into the story and you see what it consists of, you can't help but stop and think, how in the world did these people believe that they should be doing these things or they should continue or that it was a real thing? But what happened was there was a series of incidents, mostly involving fast food restaurants, where a male caller.
To me. This is just
it
crazy.
It is wild.
Me.
Like, these and are the crazy God, days and honest, nights of freaking
honest to God,
phone
what
scamming.
We are going to just. What we're going to describe here sounds like it's like on Impractical Jokers or something. It just,
it
or Candid Camera. It just, you can't honestly think that this would happen and that people would go along with it. And it just kind of blows my mind. And so a lot of times these guys, like you said, it was fast food, but they would call rural restaurants. And you know, like, you know, on the middle of the boondocks kind of thing. And we're managers were thought to be a little bit more inexperienced and likely more trusting. And this is not like, okay, we're going to call and try and get a password to a computer system or anything. This is just, like I said, you will think that this is some kind of prank. And it just shows you what people will do or willing to do when they think that there is an authority figure on the other end of the line, right?
Yeah, just simply on the other end of a line. You know, we're talking about a phone, not someone that is physically facing them holding a gun, just a simple phone call. So a male caller, he preys on these rural restaurants, he calls, asks for the manager, and he's impersonating a police officer, and he convinces each manager to act on behalf of the police department by conducting strip searches and sex acts on one or more female employees or customers.
Yeah, I mean, and like I said, he normally did this for fast food restaurants, and the caller would tell managers that you were helping the police by detaining females suspected of crime. And he would say, oh, you know, the police department, we don't have enough available officers, again, because remember, this is rural. And a lot of these police departments are understaffed and things like that. And so they want help from the public. And then he would request to the manager, hey, provide a detailed description of the female as she was being searched, you know. And it's obvious that, you know, this person was getting off to this or something, because he would want details of what was happening every step of the way and would even speak to the victims, right? I mean,
yeah, he would like put the victim on the line and then he would threaten them and have the manager go right back to the strip search, which was full body cavity searches,
mm-hmm.
assaults that lasted up to 90 minutes. I mean, they really just, they had no red line, and the managers were all willing to participate. And they were told, you know, look for illegal drugs and, you know, have the female strip and do jumping jacks. And, you know, if the manager of the, if he called a restaurant and he happened to get a female manager, he would instruct her to go find a male employee to bring into the room and have him assault the female employee. And, you know, again, the managers went along with it.
I know. And then, and it's not even just the managers going along with it. Think about the victims. They're not, you know, protesting or saying, you know, I want to call the cops, or you're not doing this to me and I'm leaving. You know, they're just, oh, okay, I don't get it. Well, and there was one, you know, it's just bizarre.
It is. And I know it's so hard to comprehend, but, you know, there is a Law and Order SVU episode, and it is inspired by this whole freaky scam and the university study by Yale called the Milgram Experiment. And it talks about how people are willing to abandon common sense for unreasonable obedience to authority. And these victims, while they were on the stand and in their depositions, they said they gave compliance because, you know, they were fast food workers. They were taught to serve, you know, how can I help you? How can I be of service? And a lot of them were really young. We're talking like 14 to 18 and very new. Like, these were newish employees. One girl, it was her first day on the job. Another one had only been there a week. So, you know, this caller, he did a lot of research and he knew who to prey on.
Yeah, he must have, you know, especially, oh, he knew that it was somebody's first day or something like that. And, you know, there was one incident where a female manager, this will blow your minds. So, attempted to bring in a male cook to conduct a search, but he declined. And he was suspicious of the circumstances, but he didn't call the police. So then this female manager calls her own fiance at home so that he could take over the search so the manager could work the restaurant's busy counter. So the fiance comes down to work and then obeys all of the caller's orders that included performing oral sex on the female employee, spanking her, fondling her private parts, and having her perform jumping jacks while naked. And the caller told the victim to comply or face worse repercussions. Okay, so we have the manager, gullible, bought into it. The cook, you know, I'm not going to do it, but I'm not going to call the cops. The fiance, oh, look, you got to come down here. The police are on the phone. You got to come conduct this search. Caller on the other end, well, what I need you to do is perform oral sex on this, you know, employee. The employee's doing, I mean, it's just, you got to be kidding me.
I mean, so many laws were already broken. I mean, the fiancé did not even work at the restaurant. He's not even supposed to be in the managerial office to begin with. He shouldn't even be addressing any of the employees. And yet, 2.5 hours later, he's still in the room assaulting this female employee. And the woman manager is coming in periodically to check on them. So she knows, you know, kind of what's going on. I mean, the girl would cover up a little bit with an apron every time that the female manager came in, but she knew what was happening because she had already heard, you know, the caller describe what he wanted done, a strip search.
And 2.5 hours.
Yes. And the thing is, like, the girl did not believe that she was able to leave. She was under the impression that it was, you know, an authority figure and that she was being held and she had done something illegal and she had to stay, when the whole time she could have walked out the doors. You know, there was no reason to detain her. But the guy, you know, has been in there for so long, the fiance, he's like, look, I got to go. You know, I have to go help my fiance with the restaurant or whatever. Even though he didn't work there, it was super busy.
Yeah. And
the caller's like, well, go find another male to take your place.
I know. And then so the manager goes, okay. And then so she tries to pull in the maintenance man, who refused and told the manager to hang up on the caller and speak to higher management. So then the manager calls the corporate office and then realizes the call she received was a scam. And, you know, thank goodness for the maintenance man. I mean, this could have gone on all night. And this led, you know, the manager started becoming hysterical and began apologizing, but it didn't prevent her from being arrested for false imprisonment. And then her fiance was arrested for sexual assault and other charges. And the couple broke off their engagement because he was convicted and got 5 years in jail. And, of course, the entire incident was recorded on surveillance cameras. You know, this is... And
yeah, the judge told him there is nothing to justify you not removing yourself from a situation contrary to common sense.
I know, it is common sense. And then at the end of this, after 2.5 hours, 3 hours, whatever it ends up being, the victim, who she's clearly in shock, but she asks the manager, do I need to come to work tomorrow? You know, it's just, this
See, that,
is the...
Yeah, that is so sad. See, she's programmed to say, how can I help you? And she's still trying to be of service. You know, she's still trying to do her job. And I think that's what really moved the jury to give him, you know, the amount of years that he got. But the victims are also told on the phone by this scam caller, be a good actress, you know, pretend it doesn't bother you. And it was a way of trying to get the managers to be more comfortable, because the more the girls fought them or screamed or cried, then the manager was more reluctant to keep going with the sex situation. So he was trying to keep these females in line.
Yeah. And, you know, they claimed that they didn't question the authority of the victims because they weren't aware that they could. Because, again, like you said, most of these victims are 14 to 18. It's a first job. You know, they're used to, oh, this is my boss. Oh, okay. Well, I have to do what they say. I don't know if I'm not allowed to say no. And, you know, and then they're listening to a police officer or somebody they think is a police officer, which just makes it worse. So they were under the impression they couldn't leave. And like you said, with that experiment, this is where that perceived power of authority carries power in the human psychology. You know, it's kind of like, I mean,
yeah. And then you have the flip side of where the managers in their HR meetings, they're trained to cooperate with law enforcement. So a lot of these incidents happened in tiny towns, you know, like Mayberry type towns. And now this is why you see businesses that are reluctant to initially cooperate with law enforcement, because there's an antitrust now. You have businesses that are leery. They want to pause for a second and process to see, you know, which direction to go in that suits their best interest. And, you know, sometimes that can be perceived as being uncooperative or obstructive, but they're just trying to figure out what's going on too.
And I think also, if you think about a smaller town, you know, they're more likely to obey authority and stuff because they've grown up with, okay, you know, you need to obey the police, you need to obey authority figures, you know, respect your elders, all this kind of stuff. And then you combine that with somebody, oh, it's my first job, I got to do a good job. I want to do a good job. I want to please everybody. And, oh, they want to strip search me. Okay, I guess I have to. And
well,
they
yeah,
just
because
don't.
a lot of these towns, they grew up knowing the sheriff. They went to school with him and they went to school with his kids. And, you know, this is a very family oriented community in a lot of these cases. I mean, there were 70 incidents in 30 states, and just a lot of these were very close knit communities. And I mean, it's just kind of sad because the one detective, a single detective, broke open this entire case because, like I said, it went on for 12 years. They couldn't figure out how to prosecute it, how to nab a caller who was using phone booths and phone cards. You know, how do you hunt someone like that back in the 90s? But this one detective was called and given the case, and he just happened to be watching Andy Griffith when the sergeant gave him the case. And he was like, "That's okay, Sergeant. I got this because I'm watching my research film right now." And I laughed so hard, and I probably thought, well, again, it's probably a Mayberry town. So he probably was.
Yeah, he probably was. And this is, like you said, a dozen years. There were 70 incidents in 30 states. Now, these are the ones where he was successful, you know? So
he called a lot of stores and they turned him down, but 70 successful incidents. That's a lot. I mean,
that is. That's 6 a year, essentially. So you're talking every couple of months, 30 states. And, you know, the phone traces proved that he was using payphones and phone cards. So it eventually leads to the arrest of a guy named David Richard Stewart, who was a married father of 5. And he messed up when he walked into a Panama City, Florida Walmart, purchased a bunch of phone cards while wearing a corrections officer uniform. And, you know, at Walmart, even back then, you know, they got top surveillance kind of systems. And they have cameras obviously trained at the registers because they're looking for employees to steal. And so he's seen making the purchase. And back then, you know, I think now if you bought a phone card or something, you'd probably have to scratch it to reveal a serial number. But then you didn't have to. So they actually saw the phone card serial numbers, and they traced it back to 9 restaurants involved in strip search incidents. And I mean, this guy, he kind of seemed relieved when he was caught, you know?
Yeah, they arrested him and he was like, "Oh, amen. It's over. Was anybody hurt?"
Yeah. Well, what happened?
Yeah, people were hurt. And you know, they went through his home, they obtained a search warrant, and they were able to find more phone cards and other damning evidence at his home. But despite his words and the evidence collected, somehow he was acquitted of every charge. It's crazy, right? They had nothing to hold him on.
Yeah, because here's the thing. You know, he called, and this is when I kind of... And it's not to this extreme necessarily, but remember, this didn't happen all that long ago, and you probably remember names because you're a whiz at this, and I don't remember names, I just remember situations. But the young woman, college student, who was arrested for convincing that guy to commit suicide, you know, where she like texted him, "Oh, you should just end it all, you should just end it all, you should just end it all."
Oh yeah, the ex-girlfriend, right?
Yeah, and there was this big deal about, can you convict her of doing something like that, right? And, you know, the guy died, so there was a little bit more of a let's, you know, do something. But even the charge that they ended up charging her with was like really weak. And I think that she got convicted and then maybe got overturned, or she didn't have to serve any jail time or something like that, or got a really short sentence. So imagine, I mean, that's a case where it's death and it's much more recent. This guy was just telling people to do that. So is he impersonating a police officer? Yes, that's a crime. But what other crimes is he really committing, you know?
Just misdemeanors, which, you know, he did this to multiple states. So, I mean, yes, the FBI will duck their head in. But at the end of the day, no one's going to extradite on misdemeanors because they're just going to get thrown out. And it's not worth the time and money for law enforcement to waste, you know, court expenses for a misdemeanor. It's literally a slap on the hand and you let them go.
Yeah. And, you know, and he worked as a swing shift guard for a private correctional facility. And his brother was a retired police officer from New York who originally posted his bond. And because it's a misdemeanor, one of the things is you could try and push to get somebody extradited for a misdemeanor, but it's not really going to happen. You generally only extradite for felonies. And so nobody's going to do anything. And they're all misdemeanors because really he had only made the calls. Again, yes, he impersonated a police officer that we know of, and then the managers had committed the crimes. That's why you had the fiance go to jail for 5 years, because he's the one who, you know, was sexually assaulted. It was the manager who falsely imprisoned this guy was just calling and saying, oh, you know what, you should go do this and you should go do this.
Yeah, like, but now there's different crime, there's different laws, you know, they're stricter. They could have got him on some type of a wire fraud and things like that. That would have been a good FBI, you know, a charge to put against him, which would have been felony. Anything to do with wire, that's what they should have went for, and they could have now. But back then, they weren't thinking like that. The judges ultimately would hear these cases, and they'd automatically turn their eyes back towards the managers and say, you know, it was you that was physically doing the majority of the harm, so I'm going to charge you. I'm going to look at you. It's just, it's, I can't comprehend how you would believe that, A, the police would call you collect from a phone booth.
Collect.
And, collect. Yeah, literally. This is a collect call from the police department. Are you willing to accept? And they're like, yeah, sure. So they're being charged already, you know? Click, click, click. It's charging the McDonald's, the Taco Bell, the Applebee's, whoever, because they were all involved. While this guy's telling them what to do, and he's like, hey, strip down these females, perform sex acts, have the women do jumping jacks while naked. And does that really sound logical that the police would ask someone to do that?
And newspapers were just aghast. They were like, come on, do you not know any better than this? And that's kind of the question you almost have to ask yourself is just, are we just so ingrained into authority? And you know, you listening and everything, I think all of you would say no. But obviously this guy found 70 people who said, yeah, absolutely. You know, and, you know, there was one headline from the newspaper was, did the manager tell a whopper? And that was because it was a Burger King manager who thought he was working for the police as he spanked a 17-year-old employee's bare bottom. I mean, yes, because the police will often call you and say, you know what, can you take that employee to the back room and give them a good spanking? You know, I mean,
yeah, this girl was 17. Another one that was spanked was 14. And, you know, she went on to be heavily assaulted. I mean, did they really in their mind think it was okay to assault children? And the judge said, no, you know, it's not conceivable. I'm not going to justify it. And each of these managers received jail sentences and, you know, they were given records of some sort. And at one point there was a second Burger King manager and he was so intent on finishing his strip search of a 15-year-old employee that the girl's father came into the store to pick her up because it went well past her shift time. And he's sitting there witnessing it. And, you know, the manager's got tunnel vision. The father ends up jumping the counter and like knocking him in the face just so that he can get his daughter back. Like he's saving her inevitably. And of course the real police were called to the scene.
Yeah. I mean, this just kind of blows my mind. It's almost like they were hypnotized or something over the phone, or maybe they thought, oh, you know, also here's the other thing is you have these managers in fast food restaurants. And I'm not talking about all managers, but especially in a town, small town like this, where it is, you know, perceived to be a position of power or something. And you all of a sudden you have these 14, 15, 16-year-olds working for you and it's a little power trip and you go, yeah, I can search them. I'm a manager, you know, and the police are giving me permission to, you know, to do this. And I just thinking that they can get away with it. And this strip scam went on until about 2003. And get this. So, you know, obviously the chains are like, okay, we're going to send out some memos. We shouldn't have to do this because all of you are idiots. But they send out restaurants warning them of the scam. But the managers kept doing it anyway. You know?
Yeah, they would say things like, oh, yeah, I read it, but then I forgot about it. And then other managers that were only 25 miles away from a location that had recently been hit claimed that they had not heard about the scams at all. So they went on to fall for it also. And you even had a global security officer that was over the McDonald's corporation say, you know, we kept calling them and telling them, but it's like they weren't receiving the information. You know, they weren't willing to obtain it. And it's like, at what point do you not just physically step into the store and say, hey, you know, clap your hands. Are you all listening? Don't take these type of calls. You know, do you understand? And have them sign like a paper or something, because McDonald's was facing litigation in at least 17 cases at the time that this was continuing to go on. That's ridiculous.
And employees were accused of being, you know, in with the caller to gain settlement money. But, you know, no, there's no proof that the victims knew the caller and the victims were as young as 14. And are they going to agree to be sexually assaulted for 2.5 hours just to maybe get some money or something? No. And in the end, there was 68 McDonald's stores, fell victim to the to this. And like you said, by the time the store number 17 was hit, managers at other locations still had not heard of the scam. And because an ex-FBI agent said that the fast food chains were so competitive that they didn't want to talk to each other about it.
And yeah, that they were reluctant to share any type of information with each other, even concerning security, you know, and they should have all been talking.
Yeah, and that Law and Order episode you had, you mentioned, it was Robin Williams was actually in it, and you know, about the scam and about the milligram experiment. And it's just, it's not even so much just giving in to unreasonable obedience to authority, but it's abandoning common sense.
It is such a good episode. Go look that up. Oh, he did such a good job. And of course, you know, Law and Order SVU is always like one of those things that hits you in the gut because Dick Wolf gets it right every time. But
yeah,
there's an even more uncomfortable film you can watch, and it's from 2012 called Compliance. And a lot of audiences, like you'll see a full audience go in, and then before the movie even ends, that audience is just half, like most of the people have left because it's so uncomfortable to muddle through. And it talks about the psychology behind people who go along with these type of incidents. I mean, it's just, it's really inconceivable. You cannot believe it. You watch it and you go, how did they not know? How did they not run?
And, you know, like you said at the very beginning, this caller, he did his research and he knew the names of the regional managers and he knew enough legal jargon to sound credible. And in some cases, the scammer requested that the managers fetch certain females, not by name, but by description. And, you know, he would describe the females insisting that the manager pursue them. And then the locations were not in the same state. And this is really, you know, obviously the internet was around and things like that, but it's nothing like it is now. But the caller, someone he knew, must have had eyes on the females at some point. You know, physically looking at them in person or through the surveillance, you know, was he hacking into the surveillance cameras? Probably not, because if you go back to 2003, you're really not talking a lot of Wi-Fi. You know, everything's kind of hardwired. So it would have, you know, in the surveillance systems, you know, they're local. They're not going up to a cloud. They're not going somewhere else. So it's really remarkable the amount of research this guy must have done, you know, into each one of these stores.
He could have been sitting across the way with binoculars and surveillancing that type of style, or again, having someone that he knows go in and shop the store. But he was able to describe these females, how their hair was, what color, their eye color, what they were wearing, how their bow was tied, because, you know, they had uniforms and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It's exceptionally creepy when you look at the court papers.
Yeah. So, you know, he must have been close. And like you said, he didn't know the name. He just knew their description.
Right.
So, you know, just being out in the parking lot or something like that and looking. So that brings us to another one. And this was also in the 90s. And, you know, that's the other thing that we need to think about, because nowadays, if you have a phone number that pops up on your phone and you don't know it, you can Google it before the thing even stops ringing. And you could go, oh, yeah, I need to answer that. Or, no, I don't know who that is, kind of thing, right? But that's not something that was and your phone didn't come up saying scam likely or whatever. So this was in the 90s, and it was 1-800-GOLF-TIP. And there was a billboard or something, right?
Yeah, it appeared firstly in Ontario, Canada, on something called Welland Avenue in St. Catharines, which was a really strange place for a billboard like this to crop up, considering that what it initially was meant to advertise was something out of the United States and Louisiana at that. But it was a billboard that stayed up long enough to pique people's curiosity. And, you know, when they got bored, it was mostly teens. They would go to the phone booth and say, you know, I'm going to test this number out. And they fully expected to receive golf type of information,
yeah,
because
of course
the billboard showed a golf club and a golf ball and a putting green, and you know, it was very welcoming, inviting, colorful. Nothing about it was sinister, and I've looked at it several times. It doesn't look to have any type of ciphers in it. So they called, and they did not receive golf tips. Not
no.
at all.
They would get some guy. It was a recording of a man who had some kind of Middle Eastern accent, Indian, something like that, counting to 10 repetitively, 1, 2, 3, like this, just over and over. And then the recording ends with this siren that was supposedly a Bell telephone audible tone that callers typically heard after reaching a number no longer in service. And it doesn't appear that the tone was added in. And get this, you have to stay on the phone 11 minutes to get that. So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. For 11 minutes. And okay.
Yeah, then there's this like long pause, and then that just the most annoying siren, which I went back and researched like tones, and it's definitely linked to that Bell telephone service, and it was to let you know to hang up. You know, it was their way of running you off the phone. It's like a jump scare.
Yeah, but 11 minutes if somebody counted to 10 in a Middle Eastern accent, and the phone number is 1-800-GOLF-TIP. And some people recall the recording pausing between counting certain numbers, which led people to question, okay, is it a code or a cipher? And you said, you know, it doesn't appear to be. And then others remember the man counting seamlessly, like he's testing a microphone, like one, testing, one, two, three, kind of like that, or creating a placeholder for the number. But who? This is the huge question. And then it leads me to like all kinds of CIA stuff and everything like that.
Right. And that's where everyone wants to go. They believe it is some type of Morse code. It is some type of spy code. And I've listened to it several times. And I tend to think it's something just less nefarious than that. I do believe it's a placeholder only because it's original origin in the fact that the company that goes on to take it over, they're really naughty. I mean, they're nasty to their customers. I mean, it's all over the internet.
Because, you know, who would go through the trouble of purchasing a billboard that doesn't do anything, right? I get it. 1-800-GOLF-TIP, call it. And, you know, it's a billboard and you get golf tips and we're going to sell you some golf clubs. I got that. If it doesn't make any money, it doesn't make sense. Here's, I think, one of the questions that you asked, and this is where I'm at with this. Was it a social experiment?
You know? Or was it a lost number that turned into a number phone catcher designed to collect maybe active or unknown unlisted numbers? Imagine that you go to call the number and you're thinking you're going to get the golf tips, or you're calling a number thinking it's your old friend. You don't realize that it's turned into an erotic sex line or some type of telemarketing scheme. And now that person, they've trapped your number and they can keep selling you, and you're going to start getting all these different telemarketing cold calls.
No, I get that. I mean, but here's the thing. It's the 90s, right? So it's a billboard. And not everybody obviously has nobody really had a cell phone then. So you're going to go home and then call 1-800-GOLF-TIP. You're going to do it from a payphone. So the number collecting thing, I get that now. And if you know these scam calls that I'm talking about, if you actually answer them, there might not be anybody who actually comes to the phone in time to answer because they're calling so many. But they make a note of the fact that you answered it. If you open up a phishing email, you know, whether or not you obviously click on something in, but it's piques your interest enough where you click on it, there's somebody back there who knows that you opened it. And so what we're going to do is we're going to try something a little bit more sophisticated to see if we can get a little bit more information from you. Because obviously, if you don't have, say, a Bank of America bank account, and you get an email that says, oh, you're Bank of America, you're not going to open it. But let's say you do have a Bank of America account, and you click on it just to see, and then you look at the email address and go, okay, well, you know, Bank of America doesn't use a Yahoo email address, but you opened it. So now they know that you probably have a Bank of America bank account. And, you know, it's just those little tiny things, and then the AI system. So I get what you're saying about collecting the unknown numbers, but I think it was, you know, a different kind of thing. And, you know, something I talked about earlier this week, and, you know, the people, the Jen Shaw thing, where her company, it's the same kind of thing. If you were gullible enough to buy a fake, you know, something or respond, then they're going to sell those numbers because, oh, this person responded, this person bought something, and you want to sell those numbers. So I get the whole number collection, but I just
don't
know.
They're looking for active accounts. And if you do not play dead, they are going to just keep coming at you with different type of scams.
Yeah.
But, you know, a lot of people question, you know, was this golf thing? See, the billboard outlasted possibly the original, maybe, renter of the number.
Oh, gotcha.
So that was weird. So people thought, you know, was it an erotic hotline that was disguised, you know, as a less nefarious shell? And that way, you know, men could call it and it wouldn't look suspicious on their phone bills. But, I mean, you can't make money off a 1-800 number. There's no guarantee of income. Those numbers for erotica are usually reserved to that 900 number bank unit, and it's charged, you know, to your carrier by the minute. It's a guarantee. So while you get service privacy, they get guaranteed payment. So again, what was this 1-800 number? What was it going to be used for? And why did they keep the billboard up? And when you do internet search engine inquiries, okay, for 1-800-GOLF-TIP, the results are redundant for a Mayfair Communications. And they apparently acquired that number back in 1998.
Yeah, because it's a good number. And you also have to remember back in the early 90s, if you had an 800 number and somebody was calling you, remember this guy's talking for 11 minutes. It was generally 25 cents a minute that the person's paying who owns the 800 number. So they're getting charged a ton of money, and there's not anything. I get the whole point of being forwarded to a 900 number from an 800 number and kind of tricking people into that, and then all of a sudden you're getting billed. But that also would only work if you were calling from home. It wouldn't work if you were calling from a payphone. And like I said, nobody really has cell phones. It's just a bizarre thing, but
yeah, and a lot of people, they admitted they called from payphones. So again, I don't know what was in it for this Mayfair company, because when you look up the company, they are registered to Pennsylvania, United States, but their intentions are not clear as to what they operate, what they intend to do. There's no website, there's no contact point, and the company name, you know, it references multiple phone scams. There's a lot of complaints against them. And it seems like then a company came in called PrimeTel, and they absorbed a majority of Mayfair's number bank.
Okay.
And,
okay, you
know, you can't tell if PrimeTel also absorbed Mayfair, if they're coexisting together, or if, you know, PrimeTel is just a subsidiary. But, you know, Mayfair, it was an empty shell from the start. So, you know, it's a shadowy thing just to begin with.
And a PrimeTel is a company, I mean, this is a company that collects discarded phone numbers and then redirects them to more lucrative lines such as adult phone sex and stuff. And then they pull callers from wherever they advertise, plus new contacts who randomly call the number without realizing it's now a sex line. And then they collect that caller's number, but also the business. So I get it now. I get why PrimeTel and Mayfair or in it to collect the numbers, and, you know, 1998, and it is golf tip. I mean, it is a good number. I mean, that is something that somebody would want to buy.
Oh, yeah. The most lucrative numbers are anything that spells out words. And, you know, all of this predates the do not call list. That didn't come along until the 2000s. So you're at the height of the 90s telemarketing schemes, and when people were still, you know, very apt to answer a cold call and speak to people, and, you know, they would take a gamble on stuff like that. And you just have to wonder why a company would give up an exceptionally valuable number, especially one that could be a twofer. I mean, this could have been 1-800-GOLF-TIP, or it could have been 1-800-GOLF-VIP. If you look at the dial pad, I mean, it had potential, and they spent money marketing in newspaper ads, on billboards. So how they lost the call just really piqued my curiosity. And, you know, I just started just Google researching the historic archives to see, you know, who had originally owned it.
And, you know, you made a very good point, is that prior to cell phones, you know, telemarketing, if you got a call on your home number, first of all, you didn't have caller ID. So you just answered calls. And, you know, and a telemarketer could get you, and a lot of times people go, I'm not interested, they hang up. But that was, you know, the peak of telemarketing, because there wasn't caller ID. And so people would just answer the phone. They didn't know who it was on the other end. And, you know, these calls were still generated by, in many cases, the robots, robotic calls or whatever. But so they could sift through them. It's not some guy in a back room somewhere calling, although that did happen and does happen. So, but people would just answer the phone. And, you know, nowadays, as soon as caller ID came around, an unknown number, you're not going to answer it. So, you know, that was a time, and it's just, it's an odd thing that in just Ontario, golf tip, a 1-800 number, and then it just leads to, it is bizarre.
Yeah, because just, while this number bank can appear to be U.S. based, they actually park a lot of their call centers and talent overseas. But through the historical newspaper search, I found at least two articles that dated back to December of 1994, and it was soliciting golfers worldwide to receive free instruction through PGA of America, and USA Today sponsored it. And the hotline, it was free, and it was supposed to be staffed by 100 PGA members in conjunction with something called Tommy Armour PGA Teaching and Coaching.
Yeah.
And it was a summit in New Orleans. And it says call 1-800-GOLF-TIP and you'll get, you know, maybe even Tom McCrary. And he had his own teaching center, and to this day, he still has a 1-800 number that you can contact him at. It's not this one, but, you know, an additional one.
Yeah. So, you know, I mean, that's kind of, and there was a Golf Tip magazine, so there was a point for it. I get that. But it was just so weird that when you called it, even though there's somebody who actually, you know, PGA and classes and all that kind of stuff where you could use it, that it led to nowhere. And did it lead to nowhere because it was in Canada and, you know, they're calling in Canada and this is a USA, you know, 800 number? I mean, nowadays it doesn't really matter, but back then in the early 90s, it may have mattered, and the 1-800 number might have only worked in the US, but they put a billboard up in Ontario thinking that, you know, maybe Americans were going to see it and they're going to drive past back across the border and call it. Because I don't think we know what happened if you called 1-800-GOLF-TIP in the US, right? Or we do? Is it the same kind of thing? I don't know.
No, we do not know what type of information the PGA members were giving to people who called the line at the time it was active. Here's the thing. It was only active for 2 days. It was a limited time thing from 9 a.m. to 9 p.m. 2 days only. You could get expert opinions. After that, the phone line would become defunct. Either they offered information on how to join the PGA charity through Tom McCrary, or they offered additional golf information, but then something happened with the number bank. It seems that whoever rented the number, let's get it straight. The number was rented from the Mayfair company. So PGA and USA Today, none of them actually owned it. They were renting it because they liked how it was spelled out. Golf Tip was good for them because they were always advertising in this golf magazine. There's at least 800 good tips on how to play golf. So they rented a number. And then it's much like when you rent an apartment or a home, your renter, you know, your landlord can go up on you and rent. They asked an astronomical fee to keep the number. And the PGA supposedly got hit with a bill that was also astronomical. And they're like, we're not paying this. You know, we're offering a free charity. We can't afford this. And it went into some type of alleged litigation. And then ultimately, you know, they lost the number. Mayfair won.
Yeah, see, I could see that. Okay, so Mayfair owns the number, decides, you know, because what they did was they went and bought 800 numbers that worked well. Like you said, Golf Tip, Golf VIP, they buy these numbers. The PGA wants it, so they make a deal. We're going to rent it from you for a couple of days. And what, you know, Mayfair does, because remember, Mayfair is going to get, you know, make a certain amount of money on this, so then they could put up some fake billboards in Canada where it's maybe not going to work, and you keep the people on the phone for 11 minutes at a time. You know, listening to this guy count, and you know, the dollars just keep racking up and racking up, and maybe Mayfair is only having to pay 10 cents a minute, but they're charging the PGA 25 or 30 cents a minute, and all of these people are staying on the phone 11 minutes and not getting any tips. So, you know, that could be a scam that Mayfair was running against the PGA and others. But we only know about this one because there was a billboard.
Yeah. So they were basically accused of alleged blackmail, holding a number ransom. And since the number wasn't renewed, they were able to legally put it back in option for resale or repurpose, which they turned it into a sex line. And that's what they do to embarrass companies. But it was said that the PGA had hired a Canadian man to obtain, you know, the Golf Tip line, and he was supposed to maintain it. And he's the one who put the placeholder there in case the PGA wanted to come back. That's him saying 1, 2, 3, 4. That was his original placeholder before they turned it into the 2-day PGA call-in line. So the company Mayfair actually went back to his original recording, giving them like a cool down period. You know, we'll give you 10 days to rethink this, pay the absorbent fee or lose the number. And he was like, you know, no, just keep it. We're not going to renew.
Yeah, because it would look very embarrassing if the PGA had this massive advertising campaign, marketing campaign saying call 1-800-GOLF-TIP. And then after a couple of days, it doesn't work. And then, you know, a week later, if you call 1-800-GOLF-TIP when all this advertising material is still out there and it goes to a phone sex line.
Oh,
then...
and boy, does it. When they answer the phone now. Oh, it's very embarrassing because PGA is a family company. And when they answer the phone, you know exactly what you're getting. It is very, very sexual.
Yeah. So, you know, it's a very interesting phone mystery. to me, it seems like a scam that, that Mayfair did against a lot of companies. And like you said, was trying to blackmail them. And these kind of scams, if you think about it in modern terms, you know, you would see people who hack into computers and then they hold them hostage until you pay a ransom. Same kind of thing, because they could get directed anywhere these people want you to go. It would be the same kind of thing. I think that they assumed that the PGA was a bottomless well of money, and we're going to stick them with some massive bill, and they're not going to like it, but they're going to pay it, and they didn't expect the PGA not to pay it. And they said, well, fine, here's what we're going to do, and we're going to forward it to a sex line, and maybe that'll shame the PGA into paying it, you know?
I think you're exactly right. Like, you nailed it. And, you know, I can understand maybe why hometown people would have called the number out of interest. You know, the billboard was sitting out in front of their homes, but, you know, why people all over Canada and the United States continue to call a repeated number they knew was a scam is beyond my understanding. You know, how bored can you be?
I know. And I think that if you talk about mid-90s, I mean, that's message board time on the internet, where it feels like there was just nothing but bulletin boards and message boards on the entirety of the internet. So, you know, you could say, oh, look, and it spreads around the message board, and so people keep calling it. I could see, like, why that would keep going, but I really think it was just a scam and that these Mayfair people would do it. And then, you know, if it's not going to cost you any money and you read about it in a message board and you want to hear this mysterious voice going 1, 2, 3 or whatever, you might want to call it. And then eventually it turns into a sex line, and then, oh, you know, it's not working anymore. The 1, 2, 3, 4 guy is not there anymore. And then it just kind of falls off. But, you know, the internet isn't everything, every time, forever kind of thing. And so people digging around on old message boards hear about the 1-800-GOLF-TIP and call it.
Yeah, it's kind of like 4chan's become the new IRC back in the day. You know, the IRC is where you would find all the gossip about the 1-800-GOLF-TIP. And then, you know, today 4chan is all over it. And then the Redditors, they like to piggyback off of it. But to me, it seems like the mystery solved, that, you know, it's a rental number bank and there's a misunderstanding and they lost the number. I would be interested in knowing how many of the people who called this scam line and then went on to receive a bulk of telemarketing calls. You know, I think that would be like the interest point.
Probably a lot, you know, because you're gonna always track those calls and then put them into your little computer program and stuff like that. I mean, they're always doing that. Or if you have some, you know, if you're in LA and you have a 310 area code, you know, all these scam calls are 310 area code, you know, and some variety of other digits that are spoofed. But because it's a 310, you go, oh, I'm going to pick it up because it must be somebody I know. It's local, right? It's not some 800 number, but that's not true.
Yeah, that's what they do. They make you think it's your friends calling. And there was actually this huge, do you remember the Californians that were hit by the, like, a thousand phone scammer who tormented people in 2017 to 2018. He would send like 900 text and phone calls within like 20 minutes.
Yeah. I mean, it is crazy. And it was Californians who owned YouTube accounts. And this guy, the username Tom Edgington, quite the name, would randomly seek out YouTube comments to respond with, hey, you know, I know you're from school. I'd like to reconnect. Call me at, and then left his number. And then he would go on to private message the person info that was convincing enough that perhaps Tom Edgington was an old schoolmate. And then if you called that number, you were screwed. You know, you were screwed.
You know who Tom Edgington sounds like?
Who does Tom Edgington sound like?
Your chess guy, your English guy. That's like a name that he would have chosen.
It is. It is. And also, you know, it's like, you know, back in MySpace, oh, everybody got the friend. So yes, it does sound like that. Because if you called this number, you would get, like you said, 600 to 900 text and phone calls daily or weekly. It depended. I mean,
again, they would fill up your voicemail box too. They made sure that you could not have real contact with your official clients or your official friends. They had taken over your entire cell phone life or your entire landline life, you know, whatever number they had, you were being targeted and harassed.
Yeah. I mean, and so if you called the number, so you got these odd sounds, kind of, you know, people said, oh, it's kind of like, you know, a Cold War kind of thing. And the program station sounds and number codes, nothing that really made sense. But one thing was certain. I mean, this abuse was day and night, and originally it seemed to happen to AT&T customers. So they were the first carrier that were met by the issues, and AT&T said, okay, well, what you should do is change your number, which costs money, and then it's a big pain in the butt, or purchase their $3 app that blocked suspicious spam, risk callers, and bots. But, you know, you can't just change your number, especially nowadays where, you know, I know we all make fun. Oh, new number, who this? You know, but nobody changes their number. Everybody has the same number. It's free long distance. And, you know, you can live in Los Angeles and have a Omaha, Nebraska area code. And everybody goes, that's okay. You know, I mean, it just, that's fine.
Well, yeah, because people, even if, yeah, if they move, they tend to keep their number because it is linked to their business, their livelihood. They've spent money marketing it. It's everywhere. It's been everywhere for years. They don't want to change it because it's a loss of income. And then someone else who gains the number later is just going to, you know, gain the contacts that you have spent so much time gathering. And the thing that really bothered people was that AT&T never put out any type of official statement. They didn't seem to care about, you know, anything that was going on with their customers. And, you know, people started to wonder, do they want to clear this area code? Are they trying to run us purposely off of our numbers? Are they just wanting to sell us the $3 spam program? Like, you know, what's up with AT&T being reluctant to help?
Yeah, you know, and this is the thing. People will, you know, they will chase you out of an area code because they want to do new area codes. But this calling and texting, it just grew more intense, and people were being researched. People were being swatted. People were being threatened. They feared for their lives. And then these phone scammers, the language they were using was brutal. There was this one real estate company that got hundreds of spam calls, and they couldn't conduct any normal business with real clients. And then if they said, okay, well, we're going to have to ditch the number, then, you know, every penny they'd ever put into marketing over the years would be lost. And real estate companies are one of those companies that really try and come up with a catchy number to make it really easy to remember. And then they would have had to lose that. And then it got to Verizon. So you have another customer, you know, complaints and stuff like that.
Yeah, and there just happened to be this one guy, though, who was super savvy in the IT tech department, and he knew how to do the discovery process of getting the coordinates of where the spam calls were coming from based on the tower pings, and he documented the entire journey on 4chan, and he even drove to the California location, and I sent you the address, like, so that we could look at it. And
yes,
I don't know where this is, but it was like a completely isolated area, and it's carved out of the mountains, and it's surrounded by a dense national forest. And I mean, it does look like, he described it as an abandoned Area 51, and it does look like that. And there's video of it on YouTube.
I forgot to click on it.
I mean, it's just creepy.
I clicked on the thing. Okay, here's the map. So
it looks like a place that, yeah. Go look at that map and tell me, like, I don't even know what national forest that is. But I mean, when you look around, it looks like a place that you are absolutely going to get murdered.
Yeah. We just did the national parks killer too.
So this 4chan guy, while you're looking at that map, you know, he's digging around and he happens to look down in the bushes. And there is a bag that is torn open, and there must have been thousands of busted cell phones. I mean, old cell phones, the flip kind, you know, the newer kind. He posted a photo of it.
Yeah, and I've got the photo that you're looking at when you look at the post. You can see it, and it's out in the middle of the woods, and there's, I mean, I would say there's 1,000. I don't think that's overestimating at all. I think that there's a good solid 1,000 phones in this pile. And the bag was torn. The phones are scattered like squatter style. And you could tell that some kind of operation had occurred with these phones. And he said, you know, I'm not touching these because I'm not about to be involved in whoever was using them. But I think they got e-cycled phones basically that were turned into a cell phone company. Cause every time you go turn in, you know, get a new phone, you're turning in the old one.
And employees of cell phone carriers have claimed that that's probably what happened because they said in the back of the majority of the AT&T or Verizon stores, there are bags and bags of these types of phones that people turn in because it's illegal in the state of California and in most states to just throw out cell phones into landfills because it contaminates the groundwater. And, you know, once the 4chan guy located the phones, he called out AT&T and said, okay, are you still not going to address this? And then he gave the coordinates of where he found the phones. And then shortly after that, his account was deleted and he just disappeared.
He did. And that was kind of, you know, maybe he said, you know, I did what I wanted to do. That to me was kind of a weird thing, that he did that. I just, he wanted to prove that he could do it, I guess, maybe.
Yeah, maybe. But I mean, like a year later, then Reddit, of course, you know, they decide to be detectives and pick up where he left off. And they start telling their stories of how their family members were victims of this scam, too. And they're very bothered by the whole squatter situation of the cell phones being found and the fact that it now it's sinking in. It's a real operation. Someone was physically holding those phones and now they're all scared for their life. And this guy talks about his aunt and how she was bombarded with just so many numbers that, you know, she didn't even know what to do. And it was like, it's really creeping her out. And he's like, you know, what do we do to protect ourselves?
And I'm not sure exactly how he even managed to find them, because honestly, you guys, I will post the coordinates if you want to see it. But if you're from LA, it's essentially looks to be about 40 miles to the east of Mount Baldy and about 10 miles to the west of the 15. You know, it is in the middle of absolutely nowhere, 40 miles north of the 210. It's just in a forest. So I'm not even sure how. There's no roads that I can see. There's like a little, looks like, you know, like a fire road or something. But even the fire road appears to be a couple of miles away from where he found it. So
yeah, it does seem like that he was like in a Mustang. It does seem like that he traveled there through one of those like hot shot routes like the firefighters use. And I mean, it was rough. I thought he was going to like bust his tire or something, but I couldn't tell where it was just by looking at it, because it doesn't look like a place that, you know, anyone would want to travel or go. And so I'm like, I'm going to get you to look at it and you tell me where it's at.
You know, it's kind of, I know where it is. I can't imagine anybody just, and then it seems like an odd place to dump a bag of phones too. There's, you know, just throw them in a dumpster. I don't know. It's a bizarre thing. I'm going to post, like I said, I'll post the coordinates. I'll post the photo of the phones and everything. It's almost like
they went to a place where they knew they were guaranteed to not be surveillanced. There's, you know, no cameras going in, no cameras going out. And, you know, that it was a place for them to conduct their business. And then I don't know why they left evidence behind, you know, especially in a bag that could be easily ripped, because animals are going to check out anything. You know, they probably tore it apart. And
it is bizarre. And then the whole AT&T thing, you know, were they really kind of, you know, doing it? And then you said you found out that, right, that the YouTuber went and followed up and that they were gone. But did we... The one guy said, I didn't take them with me. I didn't want to, but maybe he did end up taking them.
He should have looked at them. I mean, you're already there. I would have opened a few and, you know, you put gloves on, open a few and see if they'll power up and see if they are people that are deceased and if their information is still inside. Because a lot of these people, like a woman named Kim France, said that she was also in real estate. She received 700 calls a day that ruined her business. And she said a lot of the people that she researched hadn't been actual real people. Those were their real numbers, but many of them were deceased.
Yeah, because, you know, you're just throwing these phones and stuff and everything. And
at least we could have figured out where those deceased people or the family members took their phones to be e-cycled. And then you could have narrowed down who the person was that stole the phones and was doing all of this harassment.
And she installed robocall blocking tools, but there was no match for it because, you know, the anti-robocall services where it says, you know, like scam likely and stuff. It's a blacklist of known scam numbers, but it's not flawless, especially now when you can spoof, you know, the numbers and everything. And she said that the calls were kind of like a fax machine and they would leave long voicemails that filled up her voicemail. So then, you know, when her clients called and wanted to leave a message, they couldn't. She wondered if it was her competition. I mean, that's a possibility, but unless you're this super real estate agent or whatever, and some, that seems a little bit off.
I don't believe she was targeted. I know that she feels like that's what was happening and she was really scared. She contacted the police. She hired a consumer rights attorney. She was trying to sue Verizon Wireless and the calls just kept coming in. And I had a burner phone once, and it too, I had never used it, but it was receiving all these different spoof caller threatening voicemails. I mean, they were awful. And the police, they couldn't do anything about it. You know, I just inquired because I'm like, how do you handle this? You know, how do we go about figuring out who these type of people are? And when it comes to swatting and spoofing, they still just have no good way of tracking people down like that. I mean, they're at a loss.
No, they don't know. And the thing is, with burner phones, it's numbers that have been used before.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you want to be totally, well, I mean, safe for at least the next year, what you do is you find a brand new area code and you get a phone from that. You never put it down as, you know, as your number, and you will not be bothered, at least for, you know, a year or so. And just, you know, that's the only thing that you can do. And so maybe that's what AT&T really wanted. They're like, okay, well, maybe if everybody goes to this new area code, because we know that they won't be bothered. But just tell people that. Just say, hey, well, they did say go do an area code. But I think also they didn't want to have, if they did some kind of statement, then people would go, AT&T is a crappy company. You know, they're allowing this to happen. But if they don't make a statement, then it's just kind of word of mouth kind of thing. Oh, AT&T is not doing this. But there's no newspaper articles that I saw really that said AT&T is screwing over the company, you know, the customers and stuff. They tried to keep it as quiet as possible.
Yeah, AT&T, they've been involved in a lot of different strange scandals, and they always distance themselves from liability. But someone was able to track down the Tom Edgington's YouTube account, and he had a really weird video on there about sadness. And it was talking about how people needed to cut off their arms and legs and then go to the coordinates and call a number. And I assume it's his number again. So this is one messed up person.
Yeah, and it said, we have your IP. And, you know, this YouTube user was like, I was fine, but I always use a VPN, but my VPN crashed. And so now I'm not sure if it's possible for them to get my address, and I'm unsettled. And is this going to happen? And, you know, I'm in the UK. And then Tom's page requires, you know, permission to view his videos, which is also suspicious. And there are two men named Tom Edgington in California. There's a junior and a senior. And we can't be sure if that's the real name of the person. I will say this. That the address that is given for Thomas is very close to where...
Is it? That's what I wanted to ask you. Is that address close to those coordinates?
Okay, the address is in Upland, California. And Upland, California is a little bit to the west of Rancho Cucamonga, which is the closest large city to where it was dropped off. I would say, let me see if it'll give me directions to the coordinate from that address. Hold on. From Upland, California to that actual coordinate is 23 miles. So not that far. You know,
it's very interesting because when you look at that address, and again, absolutely no guilt implied, just researching, yeah. Digging. It's what we do. Enter at your own risk. This home also has multiple people living in it that have, names that would make you think they possibly live overseas. So, it, you know, multi-house dwelling, lots of people living there. You know, it might jive that they could possibly, maybe, allegedly have something to do with multiple cell phones being dumped somewhere. Or maybe these people passed away and their identities being used.
Yeah, I think that possibly, I mean, there is a road. You could do it from where they lived, for sure. The road cut dead ends where that bag of phones was found. But, I mean, that's really a coincidence that it's that close. 23 miles is nothing. So they would have definitely kind of known that area a little bit. You know, so I don't
very,
know.
Very, very interesting.
What about, let's do one last one. Let's do, and I remember when this happened, the Royal Radio prank call scam. Right.
Oh, the hunt for liability.
Yes.
Yeah. In 2012, you know, Duchess of Cambridge, Catherine, she was pregnant with her first child. That was Prince George, right?
Yes. And very ill with her first child.
Here's oh,
first of all, she used a surrogate, but let's pretend that she was sick. Okay.
Okay. So someone was sick for all intents and purposes. Someone was sick and, you know, she was under her name admitted to the hospital and it was for wrenching, which is, you know, not being able to control your morning sickness.
Yes.
And an Australian radio station picked up on the fact that she was admitted And they decided that they were going to place a prank call to that hospital pretending to be the queen.
Yes. And you guys, go back if you don't remember this. It was such a big deal when it happened. And it just kind of, I am always in awe of pranksters that can pull this kind of thing off, because I feel like I would just break. And, you know, they did it, and it's fantastic that they did it. Just because I just appreciate the efforts to get through. And then also, again, this goes back to the very first thing we talked about. You know, you just assume, you know, you abandon all common sense, because this person's calling, impersonating the queen, wanted to know about the health of Kate. And this nurse answers the phone at the nurse's station, and she falls for the scam because she's, you know, oh my gosh, it's the royal, you know, and all of this kind of, I have to do it. I'm following authority, right?
Yeah, the queen called, you know, quote the queen, and said, I would like to speak to my granddaughter. And, you know, she was like, oh, yes, ma'am. Yeah. And, you know, she patches the pranksters through to Catherine's room, and they were able to get her actual midwife. And then from there, you know, information was leaked that was very personal.
Yeah. And this is where, you know, like I said, I appreciate what the pranksters did, but it's at some point, you know, there has, this should have turned out to just be a harmless prank. But in many of these cases, we don't know who's on the other end of the line and what their situation's like and what their mindset is like and what their health is like and what something of being embarrassed like this publicly around the world is like. And 3 days after realizing her mistake, the nurse was found dead. She hung herself in the nurse's quarters.
It was ruled a suicide, and seeing how she had wrist injuries that looked like they had occurred prior to her hanging herself, it looks like that she may have rethought her plan. So yeah. It's sad that she felt so remorseful that she was willing to take her own life, and she did leave behind 3 suicide letters. But like you said, you know, I appreciate their craft of trickery and deception and being able to master that. But when it comes to HIPAA and health, and these are the royals, you know, you have to be careful about who you go after publicly, because this was broadcasted live.
Yeah, you know, and here's the thing is that, you know, pranks still, you know, continue and things like that. I guess my problem with this particular group of pranksters was they should have just had a meaningful apology. You know, the disc jockey should have said, you know, this was wrong. You know, this went way too far. We had no idea that something like this would happen, just some kind of deep, deep apology. But the problem was that the apology was woven into a continued promotion of the prank on social media. This is like when somebody apologizes and says, buy my new record that's coming out. You know?
It's an apology. It's like a compliment sandwich. You know, your record sounds good, but you know, it needs a little bit of work. You're not that great of a singer, but you know what? Your album cover is very pretty. It's a compliment sandwich. You know, it's a negative and a positive. And even though the station went and had staff ethics training and they did this 3-hour broadcast about bullying and depression and stuff like that, like you said, they continue to advertise the prank, and it really rubbed the public the wrong way. And the public boycotted the entire radio station. And you know what happened after that?
Yeah, I mean, the advertisers, you know, they're obviously not going to give any money. And then when the money stopped, then all of a sudden the antics stopped. And you know, and then shows worldwide made decisions to cancel the prank type things. It should not, you go into it, and I don't think that these hosts went into it with any kind of malicious intent. They probably, first of all, didn't think that anything would get through. They're probably just like, you know, it's something to do to kill some time here in the morning. And we'll see if it works. And we got this number and we'll have a few laughs. But when it did go wrong, they could have gone so much with just a straight up apology. And, but to have the apology and, oh, at the same time we're apologizing, we'd like to draw your attention to this prank. You know, that it's,
they couldn't believe they pulled it off. They were so impressed with themselves and the fact that it was effective that they couldn't help but to brag. But then the flip side was that the public was coming for them with basically pitchforks, and they were involving themselves in not only the business life and the radio life, but the personal life. They were tracking them online to their homes, and that's when it became kind of scary. And the hosts began to wake up and think, okay, well, okay, maybe this is not a good thing. We should stop patting ourselves on the back. And, you know, the host ended up stepping down because, I mean, the public drove them out.
Yeah, and rightfully so. I don't think that the hosts would have been driven out if they had just had the apology and said, this is a horrible thing. We're never going to do it again. You know, obviously we had the staff ethics training, a 3-hour radio broadcast about bullying and depression awareness. The hosts had no way of knowing that, you know, what the nurse's situation was like.
They probably fully expected a call and the nurses laugh and say, nice try, and hang up on them. I do not believe those hosts thought that it would be as successful as it was. I think they were shocked, and then it became tunnel vision, you know, and they're like, oh gosh, they're buying it. So they just kept selling it. And if you go back and listen, the accents that they use for the Queen and all of that, I mean, they're awful. Cause I mean, they're Australian and they're trying to sound like the Queen, and you can tell it is a spoof.
But then, you know, it's this whole abandoning the common sense, like in the Milligram experiment, right? So,
yes.
But at the same time, they should be judged for, you know, not apologizing and all of that stuff and continuing to try and profit off of this woman's death, essentially. But at the same time, the hospital should have said, okay, because they're there. These hosts are in Australia. But, you know, her superiors, her coworkers should have said, okay, look how hard she's taking this. And then, you know, offer her, I don't know if they offered her therapy or said, look, yes, it's a big deal, but it's not the end of the world, you know? And, you know, just, it's not going to happen again. We're going to all learn from this kind of thing and just kind of put her, more at ease. It's just, but you never know. It's like, this guy named Donnie Moore in the 1986 American League Championship Series. He's a relief pitcher and he gave up a home run that lost the Angels, you know, the trip to the World Series, and he committed suicide. You never know what's going to affect somebody. When Colombia played the United States in soccer in 1994 in the World Cup, there was a Colombian who committed an own goal and the U.S. won. And, you know, he was ostracized in Colombia. He ended up killing himself.
It's too little too late. They don't approach them immediately and pull them to the side and say, hey, it's going to be okay. You know, I'm going to sit with you. We're going to see this through, because there were no personal charges filed. The nurses didn't face any charges. The host didn't face any charges. The radio station, of course, was sanctioned. They did face things and a lot of litigation. But personally, the nurse would have been okay had she not, like, been dying inside of embarrassment. She just needed support. And I think that support just came way, way too late, because, you know, just 3 days later, it doesn't seem like anyone had approached her and told her it's going to be okay.
Yeah. And it's kind of a downer way to end the one, but it kind of also comes full circle with that whole Milligram experiment where, you know, just this, you abandon, you know, like you said, the accents were bad, but
we learn, you know, how to change things around and reframe the conversation and the narrative and go and read about the Hoffling Hospital experiment and the Milligram experiment and, you know, research and decide, if you were in these positions, what would you do? You know, you can learn a lot from this. And if you know someone that ends up in a situation like this, you can help them, because you're going to research this and you're going to know the right things to say. So it's actually a positive thing, you know, how to look out for yourself and how to look out for others.
Exactly. And that is a perfect way to end. Look out for each other. Be good to each other.
That's right. See, that's Happy Easter. I brought you no murder. I brought you very good tips this time.
Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure. Be good to each other. Anyway, Jen, thank you for spending part of your Easter with us. I really appreciate that very much.
It is always a pleasure. I hope everyone has a happy Easter. Please go hug all of your loved ones and spend time with them. And I will talk to everyone, I guess, next Friday.
All right. Bye.
Bye.